Our next speaker is Dr. Tom Sinclair from NC State. So again, our first two talks are sort of focusing on what kinds of climatic or environmental conditions might be problematic for the crops and what kind of interactions do we see with regards to productivity. And the last few talks are going to focus more on genetics and responses in plant breeding on a range of different crops. So Dr. Sinclair is going to be talking to us today about improving crop water use.
Thank you very much. I just came to this presentation. The Wisdom Agronomy Society is scheduled for me to give two talks at 9 o'clock. So this is the second one, and the other one we just finished over in the other room. What I was asked to do is to look at crop water use in this talk, and what I plan to do first is to show how this is very important when we're talking about climate change. In fact, I'm going to argue it's probably the most important thing we need to consider in climate change. And then secondly, I want to look at some of the traits that we've studied as a way to improve the situation for limited water, both in climate change and under current conditions, actually. This is the results are shown in the 2007 IPCC report. And on the left is annual precipitation. On the far right is the color code for the change in precipitation. Browns are a decrease. Blues and greens are an increase. You can see on an annual basis, actually, in the United States looks pretty good. We're going to have at least the same water, maybe a bit more. This doesn't really tell the story, though. We have to break it into the seasonal, and if you look at the right panel, you'll see that the map turns brown on us, that we actually will have during our growing months a decrease in water, and particularly concerned is that tongue of a fairly dark brown moving up through the central part of the United States. These reports says we're in the shape for something like a 10% decrease in moisture. This may not even be the most important issue. It may be the change in storm patterns. One thing is suggested is that we will have less frequency in our storms. And what that means is you're going to have longer intervals between storms and a greater likelihood of drought stress developing. This may be key in our crop production. The other thing is that to make up for that infrequent storm, that each storm is going to have more intensity. And as a result, you're going to have more water that can't be percolated and retained in the soil profile. So we're going to lose more of the annual precipitation or the seasonal precipitation and not have it available for the crop. So the story seems a bit bleak. We're going to have less water coming in, we're going to be able to retain less of it, and we're going to be subjected to more periods of drought. Now, the one thing before we get into really talking about the water limitation, I want to remind you about the relationship between CO2 and water vapor. It's a fact of life that many people, or some people, let's say, maybe not this audience, forgets. When conditions are ripe for the stomata, or for photosynthesis, the stomata open, and CO2 moves inside the leaf. But at the same time, the portal opens for water vapor to move out. And so they're both driven through the same pore, and as a result, there's an intimate linkage. You can't have CO2 uptake without water loss, and for every molecule of CO2 uptake, there's a well-defined amount of water that will be lost. This was actually recognized 50 years ago by the classical analysis of by Case DeWitt, where he looked at the growth and water use from experiments that were done the first half of last century in both North America and Europe. He plotted the growth on the ordinate, and on the abscisses, the water use normalized for the vapor atmospheric conditions. They just had pots of open water. He ignored what genotype it was, what the soil condition was, what the fertility condition was, what the irrigation scheme was. He simply plotted for each species those data. And you can see for each one there's a huge range in data, but they all fall on a very tight linear relationship. That is what we said previously. Growth, CO2 uptake, is very much linearly associated with water loss. A happens to be sorghum with the steepest slope, B is wheat, lower slope, and E and C is alfalfa. Now, Champ Tanner and I, a number of years ago, actually derived the relationship between growth and transpiration equals a constant, which we call D, divided by the vapor pressure deficit. And this is essentially a representation of DeWitt's analysis, except we know what the slope is. And that slope is defined, the KD, on several variables. Almost all of them are constant. The three that vary are atmospheric CO2 concentration, the CA, so that slope will increase as the atmospheric concentration increases. And then B and C. B is the coefficient accounting for the photosynthetic conversion to plant mass. So if you're producing a lot of cellulose and starch, the value of C is high. If you're producing protein, the value is low. C represents the photosynthetic pathway, which is represented by the ratio of internal leaf CO2 concentration and the atmospheric CO2 concentration. This has a maximum value of C3 is about 0.3 and C4 is about 0.7. Water use efficiency is set by these relationships, and there's little we can do about it, and K has the constant value. From that equation, you can calculate that KD. For C4 maize and sugarcane, it's 9 pascals. For C3 grasses, wheat and rice, it's 6 pascals. For C3 legumes, soybean, peanuts, 5 pascals. And now there's experimental evidence that shows, in fact, these estimates are pretty well on target for what you observe on the field. So we're locked in here. This is the amount of describes the amount of growth you're going to get for the water you have available. Now, what we can do, gee, I'm not over yet, am I? Okay. Give me a shock here. We can rearrange that equation and put the yield on the left-hand side and the other terms on the right, and you can see we have the vapor pressure deficit in the denominator on the right, this KD in the denominator, times T, the amount of water we have for transpiration, and because we're interested in grain yield, we multiply it by harvest index. So that for any amount of transpiration, we can calculate the maximum yield. And the expression of this equation is shown in this graph. On the ordinate is the maximum maximum yield, and on the abscissa is the transpirational water available. And in the Midwest, it's commonly be, say, in the order of 400 to 500 millimeters per growing cycle. If you go up vertically from that 400 to 500 range, you'll see we say maximum maize yields are somewhere in the range of probably 12 to 14 tons per hectare. For rice, it'd only be on the order of 7 to 8 tons, which is a good yield for paddy rice, or for upland rice, but we know paddy rice yields are much higher, but of course you fully extend out with very high water availability for the paddy rice. For soybean, the maximum yield is about 6 tons per hectare. The key is, if you don't have the water, though, you start sliding down this curve. There is no solution I know of to get away from this curve, and certainly those that tell us about molecular solutions, I think, are dead wrong. There is nothing we can do to overcome the physics of CO2 and water vapor exchange. The challenge for us is to make sure we get as close to that maximum yield as we can, to use the water in a way that we get close to that maximum level. And I'm going to suggest that we actually have a fairly limited number of opportunities. And the reason I say this is, first, I exclude the concern about crop survival. In the real world, survival is not of interest to our farmers. If the question is, will that crop survive or not, he's going bankrupt anyway. If it survives, he still gets the green crop to go bankrupt with. The key is to get maximum use of the water when we already have a crop standing out there. And I think there's about only three ways to do it. One is to access more water. Two is to conserve water, and I'm going to spend a lot of time on that one. And the third is to overcome special sensitivities, and in soybean, that is nitrogen fixation. So let me go through each of those and give you some background about how that operates. Of course, when you're talking about accessing more water, essentially that's roots, getting more roots. And I want to point out, this is not an easy job, and it's not easy to figure out what we really need. First of all, you have to appreciate that faster root extension is a negative trait. If you have fast roots that go down deep, use that water early in the season, have support luxurious plant growth, you're in worse shape when drought comes along. So when people have been selecting for fast rooting, they've gotten the wrong trait. What you need is greater root length density at depth. So we have this paradox that we have to have the roots grow slower, but when they get to the depth we want, they've got to really grow. So it's really a challenge. And often I think even if we genetically could solve it, the problem in the field is that the soil presents chemical and physical barriers that have to be overcome. And that often is the real challenge, is how can we deal with that? My conclusion is experimentally that this is a hugely difficult task. The results are highly variable. They're environmentally dependent. I've gone three cycles of starting root research and quitting, and I'm currently now in another quit mode, and I hope I don't get misled again and try it again. But that's the, I admire those that want to attempt it, but it's an extremely difficult area and a very difficult one to make progress. Okay, let me talk about the traits that we've really been interested in, is the water conservation trait. There's two of them that I know about. One is that you have this thematic close early in the soil drying cycle. And by closing early, then you have an opportunity to start using in that water slowly, partitioning out so you're positioned to survive and sustain metabolic activity as the drought develops. Now, I have to point out this is just opposite of what many people talk about doing osmotic adjustment and keeping the stomata open. When you're having drying soil, the last thing you want to do is keep stomata open. You've got to have things closing down and starting conserving water. The second trait, which I'm going to spend a fair amount of time on because we're extremely excited about that, is a limited transpiration trait under high vapor pressure deficit. Let me first talk about that conserving water with soil drying, and this illustrates some of the data we've gotten with soybeans. What I'm plotting here on the ordinate is the ratio of what a drying plant is transpiring over a well water. So value 1 means that drying plant's doing exactly the same as a well-watered plant. The abscissa is the fraction of transpirable soil water, 1 being field capacity and 0 being the point where stomata close. Here are 6 genotypes of soybean. You'll see they all did the same thing. There was no change in transpiration until you'd gotten to have only about a third of the fraction of transpirable water available, and then it dropped linearly. Now, to my great surprise, we have not been able to find genetic variation for this in soybean. Now, the only thing I think of is soybean originate generally to very wet, fairly wet climates in China, for instance. So this trait never really developed. We've looked for it in other species, and there is dramatic differences in peanut, maize, and sorghum. We see genetic differences. And these, I think, can be, in fact, I'm sure they can be exploited, looking for those that have higher levels. And the level you want, when you want the threshold, depends on the environment you're designing your plants for. But certainly, the bottom line for soybean is we still haven't found it, but we haven't given up looking either. Okay, this is the trait that I'm really excited about. It's the conservation of water by limiting transpiration under high VPD. Let me use this graph to explain it a bit. On the what I'm doing is a hypothetical day, looking at through the time of day. And on the left-hand ordinate, I have the vapor pressure deficit. And it's shown in the graph as the dotted line. You'll see in the morning it starts at 0, essentially when we had dew formation, and increases through the day, in this case up to about 3 kilopascals, where a maximum value happens in the middle afternoon. And then as temperature drops, it decreases again. The transpiration rate is a solid line and shown on the right-hand ordinate. And you can see that we have this gradual increase through the day, maximizing in the early afternoon and then decreasing with light and vapor pressure deficit. Now, the trait I'm proposing was this horizontal line. We have 2 of them, but let me look at the one where we say that the transpiration rate could not exceed 0.6 millimeters per hour. Now, the thinking is that somehow the plant cannot support transpiration higher than this. So as a consequence, the stomata have to close. And with stomata closure, of course, you not only save water, but you sacrifice photosynthesis. And the question is this water saving return later in the season overcome that current loss in photosynthetic capacity? And later on, I hope I showed you that indeed, in most cases, you are rewarded by this approach. Now the question is, is there any plant material out there with this hypothetical response? And I went to Tommy Carter, the soybean breeder at North Carolina, and asked him if he'd ever seen any difference in wilting, for instance. And he had subjected his nursery to put on sand, subjected to 2 or 3 weeks of wilting, and most of the nursery was what you see on the left-hand side. The material became severely wilted, but side by side with this is this PI416937, which was delayed in its wilting, and it would be another 3, 4, 5 days before it looked like the rest of the material. I said, well, this could be it. Somehow it has saved its water, and allowed it to have this this phenotype. We made the measurements by surrounding the using chambers, changing the vapor pressure depths around the plants, and measuring their transpiration rate to see if we could see this response in the transpiration. For three genotypes, you'll see panel A, B, and D, that there's a linear relationship. Transpiration's on the ordinate, vapor pressure deficit's on the abscissa, and they increase linearly. That is, the stomata haven't changed, they're open, and as BPD goes up, the transpiration grows up. 416937 is in panel C, and you'll see it got up to a BPD of about a little over 2 kilopascals, and it went flat. Amazing that it did exactly what we were hypothesizing. I would say hope for, but I know as scientists we don't do that. But that's the kind of result we got, and we're very excited about that. Now, I'm going to divert myself a little bit to explain a bit of the physiology. So those of you that are not into the physiology, you may want to tune out and begin, and I'll bring you back when we get to back to the climate issue. What we want to know is, could this be the limitation water transport in the leaves? And we had this system where in one swipe we would cut the petiole of the leaf, hook it to a water supply, and we then measure water movement into these partially dehydrated leaves. What we found is then from that time pattern, there were actually two compartments in the leaf, a compartment that had a fast rehydration and another one that had a slower rehydration. And we could calculate the halftime. And the interesting thing was, when we look at the halftime, this PI 416937 had nearly twice the halftime as biloxi representative of a normal soybean. So indeed, water moved much more slowly into the leaves of this 416937, which we interpret as a hydraulic conductance limitation. We actually now have to discard the traditional view of water moving throughout the leaf in a bulk way, which is shown on the left-hand panel, and that there's two compartments, one hydrating probably the mesophyll area, and then a second one that rehydrates the guard cells and its neighboring cells. This is where water is being transpired. This is where the water has to move to. And if you can't supply those, then the guard cells have to close. And it's this variable resistance or conductance that would account for differences in genotypes, and we think the conductance is low for 416937. We looked at all kinds of anatomical things to see if there was something unusual in the leaf anatomy of 416937 and couldn't find it. We then hypothesized that we have a lot of water that must move through the membranes in that pathway, and it may be limited by the proteins in the membranes, the aquaporins, that allow water to flow. So we did some tests to look at that, and the major test was to expose our plants to aquaporin inhibitors. And the idea is we get an inhibitor of the aquaporins, we should see a decrease in transpiration. And we looked at several one, and we got a discrimination among genotypes with silver. And so we put the detox plants in these flasks, provide silver, and then look at their decrease in transpiration rate. This is a result of a few genotypes that we published on several years ago. On the ordinate is the decrease in transpiration rate. So any value above zero means we have a decrease in transpiration rate, and you'll see many of them, we have a substantial decrease in transpiration when they were fed silver. On the right are all the lines that had this response, up to a 50% decrease in transpiration when fed silver. On the left, you'll see is 416937 that was insensitive to the silver. And there are two other lines there, both progeny of actually 416937. Our current interpretation is that 416937 does not have this population of aquaporins that are sensitive to silver. But it also means it doesn't have that population to help move water. So it has that restricted conductance because those aren't there. And we're really trying to explore that hypothesis and see if we can have this for a basis of explaining this phenomenon. Okay, back to the real world and enough physiology. Tommy Carter, as breeders do, don't seem to want to wait for the physiology answer to all this. So the breeding, he proceeded immediately into breeding. This is some of his results where he had developed two advanced lines here shown in the two different circles. and compared their yield to check. And on the ordinate is the difference between the tolerant line and the check yield. Anything above zero means a yield increase for the tolerant lines. Below zero means a yield loss. The check yield represents the water conditions. These are all given top management. The main variable is rainfall. So you can see at the low rainfall years, indicated by things below 32 bushels an acre, in every case we had a yield increase, or he had a yield increase. Above that, you see we didn't see the yield increase. Tommy will tell you that there's no yield decrease. As a physiologist, I know at high water we have to have a decrease. The stomata have been closed, and I think if you do a linear regression, you'll see at a high yield you do have a slight decrease, but it is a slight decrease, so that the penalty in this case is small. Now the question is, where and how much is this trait a benefit? And so we wanted to look at that with our simulation model. We have a simple mechanistic model where we can simulate the growth under a range of conditions, and in this case across the United States. We simulate leaf areas as a function of temperature and the soil water condition, growth as a function of radiation use efficiency, radiation interception in soil water, and transpiration as a function of growth. So this is a unique feature in the model because many models do growth over here and transpiration over here and don't link them. And if there's anything we know in plant size or anything I tried to convince you, those two have to be linked. And this model, we link them because transpiration depends on the amount of growth. We used the Pioneer Hybrid GIS database. They divide the U.S. into 30 kilometer by 30 kilometer grids. And for each grid, they developed 50 years of weather data in each grid, so that by interpolation techniques that I don't understand. Also, as part of that was the soil type, sowing date, and the appropriate maturity group for that location. So that for the standard soybean, we'd run each of those grids in all 50 years. It'd be over 130,000 runs of the model. Then we would insert this limited transpiration trait, run it again, and see what the yield difference would be in each year. So we compare the results for each year. This is the results. I want to bring your attention to panel A. That's the probability of yield increase. And you'll see the map is pretty well pink and red. The left-hand vertical color bar is the probability. The pink is about 80% or more of the yields, years you have yield gain. So it's a pretty favorable trait that, in fact, most of those years you will get a yield benefit. There are a few cases where we're less than 50% yield benefit. I could be nasty and say those are in Canada, but let's just say they're in years that in locations where we're not having such severe stress. So on a probability scale, this looks like to be a good trait. The amount of yield gain was gotten in the three right-hand maps. In this case, in each location, I'd rank the 50 years, and then we could get the percentile in that ranking of what the yield difference was. So towards the bottom, the 25 percentile, the yield increase is shown in map D. And you'll see to this, the map is highly tight towards pink and red. This indicates that the yields in this were over 70 grams per meter squared, a substantial yield benefit in these dry years. Now the medium year is pretty doubtful. Many people identify that as a dry year. Okay, the crop probably looked okay, but it had a penalty, and you'll see that we have, again, the blue and pinks across much of the United States. The yield gains are not quite as much, probably 20 to 60 grams per meter squared in most places, but in fact, a yield benefit. And even in the driest percentile, or wettest percentile, the 75%, you'll see we're at either at zero or slightly above in yield gain in every place in the United States. So my conclusion is this is a very potent trait to install in our crops. We found this trait, by the way, in other crop species we've studied, and a very potent trait to increase the capability to get as towards as high as maximum yield as we can. I said the overcoming sensitivity is an important one, and we've done a lot of work on the nitrogen fixation sensitivity. If I had another half hour, I would certainly go into this because we've devoted a lot of effort. But let me summarize. The bottom panel, represented by Benning, shows you the sensitivity of nitrogen fixation in most soybeans. This is what I showed you before, the normalized value, with one being being the same, the drying plant doing the same as the well watered, a fraction of transpirable water on the abscissa. And you can see that as we get down to only a half of the water used out, the nitrogen fixation starts dropping. A major decrease here very early on the drying cycle before transpiration and photosynthesis drop. So we're developing a deficit in nitrogen in our plants. And for soybeans, that's particularly difficult because of this high protein grain it eventually need to produce. 417938 is another plant introduction, which we've recently discovered has extremely tolerant nitrogen fixation of this drying process. In fact, it's better than the third level, 0.35, where the transpiration photosynthesis decrease, it goes on to down to almost 0.2. So it can actually store away nitrogen in the whole drying cycle. We're very enthusiastic about this. In fact, as I said, if I had a half hour, we could show you some of the experiments where we're exploring this. But it's these special sensitivities, especially this one in soybean, that need to be looked at for the future. Well, in closing, I want to remind you of this graph. If I can burn it into your brain, there is a maximum yield for the water you get. And we cannot get any more yield than the water allows. If you have a dry year, you're going to have low yield. And we've got to recognize that and put aside some of the propaganda we hear from some of the biotech companies. They cannot double yield when you don't have the water. And we're in environments with low water, for instance, some regions, Africa, for instance, the water is a major level, is a major limitation, and it can't be overcome unless we think about a major increase in yield without irrigation. However, it's not all dismal. I think we can come much closer to the maximum yield by looking at some of these plant traits, and that's what gets me excited. We need to access more water, and anybody that's willing to take that on, more power to them. We're very excited about the water conservation traits in the plant, and I've illustrated both that, and then the special sensitivity, which in soybeans is symbiotic nitrogen fixation. Well, thank you very much. If I have time, I'll be happy to address any questions or comments.
So we have 5 minutes for questions. If anyone has questions.
There's Jim over here.
Great job here. Can you put that last reminder slide up again? There's a bit of a paradox.
This one?
Obviously, you have transpirational water and yield are linear. We all know But the question is, with your new trait, you're cutting back transpiration whenever the VPV, the vapor pressure deficit, just above the level. So it will conserve water compared to a normal unit, but it will also have the same condition later in the season when it does have water.
Yeah.
If you less, yeah, get back. So it should yield less constitutively because of that, because I didn't see any difference between where it topped off at the beginning of the season. So the only difference in that trade is conserving water, so you don't use as much early mature chain growth wise. You'll have it available later when you're both the other varieties won't have it because they'll use it too quick.
That's right.
That's a paradox a bit, in my opinion, in terms of looking at your simulated yield data across the U.S.
Yeah. Well, first of all, this is Jim Speck, who's challenging this unchallengeable physiology. I don't know what you heard Jim point out. There seems to be a paradox where we are saving water, and then we'll have a problem at the end of the season because we've also increased photosynthesis. The fact is, it's a dynamic process. If we can save water early on to have water to fill the filling period, to sustain physiological activity during seed fill, that's how we get the yield increase. Now, we don't always get it. If it's a wet year and you really don't have a drought period in seed fill, then you have a yield decrease. And that's why I say at high yield water levels, Tommy Carter's got to recognize you will have yield decrease. But by the nature in the United States of the rainfall pattern, we're seeing it 80 to 80 plus percent of the years we get yield benefit by doing this.
I guess what I would rephrase it is you're not getting higher yield, you're getting more yield than the crippled chets because they've used the water too quick, right?
Okay. Jim's background is in English, and he liked to debate semantics. This is a yield increase. Yes.
Can you explain
Okay, the question is, we didn't see this closure stomata with soil drying in soybeans, and we looked at other glycine species, is that right? We've looked at other grain legumes. I'm trying to think. I don't think we've looked at glycine. We've looked at glycine soja, and it's no different. It's no different. We've looked at other grain legumes. They do have the variation within the species. So I don't know. Of course, one of the problems is, this gets in the, Jim will have to help me. One of the things, the history of soybean, it usually comes from fairly wet climate. Breeding tends to favor irrigated nurseries, and it has a small genetic base now. And I think we just lost it. So we've got to go back and really scan to get it again.
One more question.
Okay.
I understand the early stomata closure can benefit the grain yield later in the season because it conserves the water. But how about perennial grasses like elephant grass and energy cane? We don't concern about the grain yield, but it also benefits the long growing season. So it still benefits the same.
Well, questions about how's the argument work for perennial species. The question is, where does your crop get killed? And if you don't ever have a threat of being of it senescing, then the trait probably will not be of benefit. But if you're in an environment where you have the threat of being of having senescence, which in many environments you do have, you'd lose the whole, at least the shoot, then the trait would be beneficial. So I think it's probably beneficial in many places, many species.
I lied, there's time for one more question.
One more easy question.
Just wondering, you mentioned about maize having quite a wide genetic variability and those smart clothes. Do you use any similar analyses for that, like you did with soybean, to see whether that trait
we've done it. I don't know, is Charlie Messina here? We've done it with Pioneer. We've run the corn. They either intentionally or unintentionally are slow about getting that paper out. But let me tell you, the bottom line is the trait is very desirable the farther west you go. Probably in the heart of the corn belt, it's less so. But when you start moving to drier areas, it's quite beneficial.
Okay, thank you very much.